coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody's doing great. I have had a tiring week. It was a long week in San Antonio with clients and on show, but the show went off great as always. It was always good seeing my road family, all that kind of stuff. Looking forward to some more upcoming road work soon. Looking forward to this week, actually, this upcoming week. I will be speaking at the MUFON Symposium. Very, very much looking forward to that. It starts, the 27th is really day training, things like that. But Peter Robbins, Stacy Wright, Alex Dietrich, Mark St. Germain, all kinds of great folks. Hey, look, me. I'll be speaking there. It's going to be fantastic. I am talking on aerial phenomena, scientific anomaly, cultural catalyst, and societal mirror. What it all means to the future of humanity, things like that. So it's going to be super fun. I cannot wait for it. If you are there in Kentucky or Ohio, Covington, Kentucky specifically, is where it is happening. Come on by, get your tickets, enjoy that. It is always a great conference full of great, great researchers. Speaking of great researchers, tonight we are more than happy to welcome back in the second part our good friend Gretchen Cornwall. We will be talking about the Curse of Oak Island's Templar Cave Royston with her. This amazing new book that she has put together, complete with color photos and all, as always. But it is some amazing research that she has done further into Royston Cave. And it's great to see her getting out there with that stuff. And it's also great to see our first guest returning with a new book, Kathleen Ball. She is the author of The A Grail Quest, Discovery of a Mysterious Knights Templar Cave in Brazil. She is the creator of Templars in Brazil, an amazing docuseries. You can find the second part internationally, soon to be here in America. Third part is being created. Welcome back to the show, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm great, Chris. It's great to be back.
Always great having you on. As I was telling you beforehand, I have been stoked for this show for the last few weeks since we booked it, because it's a rare opportunity that I get to speak with either one of you. Because you're always so big, both of you are constantly on the road doing research, literally hip deep in the field doing research. So it's always great catching up with y'all. There's always cool stuff that y'all have found along the way, and it's always great catching up as well. So the fact that we have both of y'all on tonight, it's just it is a Knights Templar bonanza tonight for folks that are into that. So
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, you know, actually physically meeting Gretchen. We've worked together. Mm-hmm. She did a forward for my first book, and and we've just kind of collaborated on a lot of things individually. Talked research, talked shop together, and stuff. And I'm looking forward to actually doing a project. We've discussed it, and somewhere here in the near future, I'm hoping that we can actually collaborate and get together and do something together, because our research dovetails. She's coming in from a different direction than I am. But right now we're both in Europe. She's in Royston. I'm in Portugal. My next film goes into Scotland and the UK. So we're going to be right there.
Wow.
So I'm hoping to maybe bring her on in that next episode 4. To talk about Royston and awesome. While I'm in the UK and in that area. Yeah, this will be a surprise to her because I didn't get a chance to talk to her about it earlier today, but I had discussed it with my producer. So surprise, Gretchen.
That's right. That's right. And it's so exciting to see both of y'all's materials really taking off in this kind of way, and new stuff coming out. I cannot wait for your new book. That's why we're having you on. Is the new research you have that ties into the cave in Brazil and
Yes.
Portugal, all kinds of things. So let's go ahead and start cracking that nut and getting right into it, Kathleen.
Yeah. Well, it's taking off from the cave. I have gone into Portugal now. I think it's been, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, and I'm going back again during my trip to the UK. This year, I'll be leaving on September 9th to go into the UK. I have two lectures there, one in Kidminster and one in Galway. So, in between those, I'm heading to Portugal. We've discovered yet another Knights Templar commandery
Oh,
on the
wow.
coast. Yeah, on the coast. And I was able to get it into the third episode, so which is the third episode is Secrets in the Symbols. I followed a whole lot of the Templar path into some really old churches that were built by the Templars on the coast of Portugal, which is adjacent to what we believe was a port that was used in Peniche by the Templars. And we think we finally have identified the actual port area and two commanderies at either end of this area in Peniche, with a well in the middle that was providing water to both of them. And what was interesting about this well is if you look at it from an aerial perspective, we took a drone above it and it actually is a key. So it was just mysterious. And what was even more
Interesting.
mysterious is when I went into this area to research, when I arrived at the San Leonardo Church in Atuquia, which is adjacent to Peniche, and I had already, applied for all my permission and everything with the Office of Patrimony months ahead. Anyway, so I get all set up. My videographer is all set up, but we're all set up to shoot. And in comes this person, and tells me I can't. I have to stop filming. Right?
Wow.
Well, he did the same thing, not he himself, but another member of his group did the same thing when I went to go into the well, because we were going to walk the well both directions. That was our intent. And they gave us a story that the lock on the gate was broken, but they called a locksmith and it turned out the lock was not broken, but they gave us another excuse for not going in. And so my colleague and I did some background check on this fellow. It turned out that he is Opus Dei.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. So they had a vested interest in stopping me, apparently, from doing any more research. And what was really interesting about this particular church was that the initiation symbols on behind the altar on a wall that was directly behind the altar inside this church were identical to the ones that are in my cave in Brazil.
Oh, wow.
Identical. So I was able to finally film them. I figured out another way to get those pictures, and they're going to be in the third episode, Secrets in the Symbols. They're featured in that film. But the other thing that was really fascinating is that he completely missed the fact that on the outside of the church, there was an altar. As you facing the church on the left-hand side of the church is an altar of a male and a female, a veiled woman and a bearded man with two children surrounded, the whole altar is surrounded by the fleur-de-lis, whole thing.
Incredible.
Which, right, is indicative of the bloodline, the Holy
Yeah.
Family, and the bloodline of Jesus and Mary. So that is still there in plain sight. I mean, I'm just amazed that nobody's ever discovered that. But and the whole exterior of the church around, the, right under the roof, or the whole entire church all the way around is narrative. It's an ongoing narrative that the Templars built into that church. You know, that some at some point, I hope that I can, you know, get together with somebody and we can actually, you know, try to figure out what that narrative is trying to say to us today.
Well, is it in like freeze style, or because of course, you know, there's numerous ways that stories were portrayed in such ways, you know, especially whenever you go back to Greco-Roman tradition, things like that, even stained glass. And later on with Gretchen, we'll talk about altar panels specifically in the way that they tell an overarching story frequently from left to right.
Yeah.
What kind of story does it tell along there? Well, was there anything that you could?
Some of the first Templars. That's what we think, that these maybe we're not positive, but we think that it may be a narrative, a storytelling, you know, of these Templars coming together and building of this church, and how significant this church is, like a living library. It's just phenomenal, really phenomenal.
Well, and specifically, the Templars were known for that. They put tons of esoteric, and I mean the church to begin with, whenever you go into the first step into any narthex, there is a deliberate way in which things are constructed to move you emotionally. It's pretty Absolutely. Fascinating once you get into church construction, things like that. Everything is built to represent that. And it's fascinating to begin with. But when you get into Templar churches specifically.
Right. Well, the Templar churches and the castles even, you know, the buildings that they constructed. We have to remember that when they went into Portugal, a lot of the buildings they didn't construct. Some of the castles they did not construct. They took them over after they conquered, you know. So we have, but then they would go in and, you know, refurbish them, and then you see the iconography. That's when you see the iconography. But the early Templars, especially the early Templar churches, were, and even, you know, this is all through France, this is in England, Scotland, all through everywhere, all through Europe, are built according to sacred geometrical principles, every single one of them. And very often they're built on top of a previous temple that was dedicated to Isis or, you know, some other feminine goddess. And that's the case with San Leonardo, is that it was built on top of an earlier temple spot that they don't know exactly who it's dedicated to. But in that area, the Phoenicians were in that area, you know, long before the Templars arrived. And there's also a little inlet, a canal, like a, not a canal, but a, it's like a little inlet along the coastline, and it's dedicated to Joannes, which is also, can also be translated as Oannes, which is ancient, you know, here we go. These are ancient people coming into this area. They had been apparently using this port in Peniche, using it as a port for hundreds of years, possibly thousands of years, who knows, before the Templars even did so. And what's interesting about this particular port area is that during the time of the Templars, it was not connected to the coastline. It was considered an island. It was later filled in by silt, connecting it to the coastline. But what was really fascinating to me, I looked with a colleague through the history of the nautical history in Portugal, and many of the Portuguese admirals, the naval admirals, lived in Peniche.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it was kept secret. This is the other thing. The kings, you know, all the kings in Portugal for hundreds of years kept this port secret. It was not it was not common knowledge. And it's not, if you look in their history, it's not in their history books either. You have to really dig You know, we had to really dig to discover this.
Well, what would be the reason to, because a port is kind of hard to hide, one would think. You know, it's not like nowadays where, you know, maybe you could have a clandestine place that like a cigar boat speeds into, you know, You got a galleon sized ship coming up the river, man. Right. Like it's a little hard to hide that, one would think.
Right. But the key to it is it's off the beaten path. At that time in history, everybody was going in and out of Lisbon. They were coming down the Tejo River and into Lisbon. Lisbon was the primary port. That was what was recognized as a port in Portugal that was used for commercial ships, for, you know, just about everything. Excuse me, personal travel, you know, like I said, commercial travel. That was all done out of Lisbon. So to have this little port, you know, out quite a ways outside of Lisbon it's not, you know, because people didn't have cars back then. It was a lot different than it is today.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't as accessible as, you know, as it is today, because most of the people were living in the towns or the cities that were developing, you know, that were in Porto and Lisbon, and Tomar was the headquarters of the Templars. But they lived along or outside these larger cities or towns that were populated, where they could, you know, they could easily trade. They had their farms, but it was easier to get the things that they needed if they lived near a town. Now, Atuquia was a little bitty town at that point. And it was interesting because when I looked up in Portuguese history, it shows that it was given to the Corni brothers, which the town actually was. It was that area was actually given to the Corni brothers. But what they don't talk about is that it was actually commissioned. The church itself and the castle across the street from it were actually commissioned by the Templars in Tomar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And let's start getting into specifically how the Templars kind of came into Portugal to begin with in that kind of way, and why the importance of Portugal to the right. Templars in that kind of way.
Well, that's really fascinating as well. You know, the Templars didn't, what people think, you know, they think, okay, the Templars showed up in 1118 in the Holy Land, and they were crusaders and all that. You know, everybody knows that part of the story, but they don't know that the Templars actually, the first nine knights, organized and got together. They traveled to Greece in 1040 and into Constantinople in 1090. What they were doing was gathering esoteric knowledge from all over the planet, Sufi, Islam, everything you could imagine. They were gathering all the esoteric knowledge, and they were bringing it back into Europe, and they had this opportunity to create a country, which later became Portugal, right? And so the way that they got involved in that what was known as the Reconquista, when we had a Spanish and French came together, and they hired, from what everybody, you know, understands, they hired the Templars to conquer Portugal for them. But what many people don't know is the very first king, Alphonse of Portugal, the rumor is that he was actually a Templar's son. He was not the son of the Count and his wife. He was actually a Templar's son, because they had to switch boys, because the one that was supposed to take the throne was severely severely damaged. He had problems with his legs, and he died at the age of 9. So they replaced him with his Templar's son, who was also 9, who became the first king. So there you have that explains the allegiance with the Templars and how they were able to get in and literally take over Portugal. I mean, they were embedded in every single area of Portugal. And what they were trying to do was build a sovereign nation. They wanted a template for what their later agenda was. And that was a template to see if they could put together a country. And once they, you know, once they conquered the Moors, they invited them to stay. They gave them land.
Yeah.
Once they conquered Islam, they invited them to stay. They gave them land. They took in the Druids. They took in the Celts. They took in the Christians. They took in the Jews. They took in all nationalities. Portugal was a country, a sovereign nation of equality and religious freedom right under the nose of the Catholic Church, right? Portugal was an extremely important country for the Templars. They brought in all this esoteric knowledge with the ideal, the eventual ideal of bringing about a renaissance in Europe, of raising the consciousness of the European continent. That was the agenda. And of course, we all know how that played out, but it did later happen. And I also found evidence that the Templars directly influenced many of the people that were involved in the Renaissance, one being Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci didn't, I just found this, blew my mind. I just found this last year. Leonardo da Vinci's chateau, which was connected to the King of France's castle, Francis I, was less than 200 feet from a Templar church dedicated to John the Baptist that was still functioning during the time that he was there.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And granted, I would not doubt that one bit, that Leonardo da Vinci of anybody would have connection to the Templars in that kind of way. With his Medici connections and things like that.
Yeah. And I think it began with his Medici connection, actually, you know, because you got to remember also, you know, Francis I was married to Medici.
Yeah. And they held the papacy for a long time. I want to say for a couple hundred years.
It was all working together, you know, under the rug. Held the papacy. Nobody was talking about it, but it was happening. You know, they were sharing all this esoteric knowledge. I mean, it went into England. We know that, you know. But anyway, so what they did is they literally influenced the actual Renaissance in Europe, which just blew my mind. You know, it was like, I suspected this. I had suspected this. But to find that, you know, that actual evidence was just, it was really heartwarming. It was just great. It was just a great feeling to find that out. And so, you know, their agenda, which I believe is still happening today, when they supposedly were annihilated in 1312 and, you know, 1314, Jacques du Molay was burned at the stake. We all know that happened.
Yep.
Well, they didn't go underground. They didn't go underground. They went into Portugal. They were transformed to the Knights of Christ. They went into Scotland and they took all of the gold and silver, all of the treasures, and hid them in the caves in Scotland. And little by little, they were transferring them into North America, right? This included some of the gold that they were bringing back from Brazil and also silver that they were bringing back from Peru. And this also explains why the King of Portugal, during the time that the king of the Templars' demise between 1307, 1314 was the only he was the only king, the only monarch that had any money. He was the only one that had anything in his coffers. Everybody else was broke from the Crusades. It wiped them out. Yeah. They were all indebted to the Templars, or they were near broke, but not King Denis. Not Denis. He was not. He was building. He was doing all sorts of, you know, projects. It was very obvious that he was very well-to-do at that point. And where he was getting his money was the Templars were bringing it back from South America. And here comes the secret port. The reason why they kept that port secret, because they wanted to travel back and forth from there, explore South America without anyone else in the continent being aware of it. So when they discovered Brazil and someone got wind of the fact that they had traveled to somewhere across the Atlantic, they said they discovered an island and they called it Veracruz, which means the True Cross, but they did not talk about the fact that it was an entire continent. This was the Portuguese were famous for being very tight-lipped about their travels, about what they were doing under the rug. They were very tight-lipped, and I really respect them for that. They accomplished a tremendous amount in Portugal, and I really think, and I mentioned this in my book, The Templar Agenda, the book that's going to be coming out in a few weeks, that Portugal was actually the nuts and bolts of the order, along with Scotland, after the demise. And all I also believe that it was leading up to the demise, because I think that many of the Templars left France prior to the arrest because they knew full well that that was coming down the pike.
We have talked about that before. We've talked about that with
Right.
Gretchen Cornwall. It's the fact of, hey, you're a military order. You know full well what the rumblings are in the background. You have your own spies in
Oh, you
courts.
bet they did.
Once
Yeah,
again,
they
as
would
you
have been
said,
fools not to.
most of the royalty was indebted to them in some way,
Oh, you bet.
so they had dirt on people. They knew what was happening. They knew
Right.
absolutely. It's a little hard to hide that many footsteps coming down a cobblestone road with torches. Like it's gonna echo in the distance.
Yeah, I mean, I fully believe that Jacques de Molay, I fully believe that he believed that he could negotiate with the Pope and get out of this whole thing. I really believe that he did believe that. It didn't go that way. And the Pope actually, I talk about this in my book. The Pope actually drug his heels for as long as he could. He did not go along with this whole thing. With Francis the First, he finally got sort of backed into a corner, and then we all know what happened at that point, right? But he didn't want to. This was not something that he wanted to be a part of. So I really firmly believe that, they did send a lot of their members out of France. They sent that they obviously got, the treasures out of France because there was nothing there when King Philip the Fair went looking. There was nothing for him to take other than their property. But I fully believe that, Jacques de Molay and the group of men that were arrested and taken into Dome and Chinon, where I found a whole bunch of graffiti in there. Which was it's fascinating, this graffiti. Anyway, I'd like to get together with Gretchen on that too, because some of the things are duplicate in Royston as well too. There's some duplicates in Chinon and in Dome. But anyway, I firmly believe that those 200 to 300 knights that were arrested with Jacques de Molay, they were there as a show to make it look as if. You know what I'm saying? That the order was still there, but I think all the important stuff was gone and had been gone. And we know that there was treasure also taken out through La Rochelle and in eventually into Scotland. And I think that may have been the last of it. That may have been the last of it. And many things went into Portugal. Many of the members went into Portugal as well. And I found a lot of crossover. I found crossover between Scottish Templars and Portuguese Templars. So I think that they were also working together, with their plan. And I think they attempted to go into South America, and consider that as a possible continent, to try to bring about their goal, their agenda, bringing about this country, this sovereign country of freedom and freedom of religion and equality. But when things happened that the Portuguese country, the king actually got involved at the end in Portugal and ended up, you know, claiming Brazil.
Yeah.
That kind of put a monkey wrench into that plan. So I think this is when they made that decision in 1387. We know that the Templars, that's the first time the ship went into North America. That's when they really cemented the plan to create the nation in United States of America, in North American continent, instead of the South American continent. I think that's when that decision was made.
Well, and let's get into that real quick, because that is a fascinating twist to know that. And it's been long hypothesized by numerous people. I know it's a trail that Scott Walter has been on for years and years.
Absolutely.
And even, you know, like we just had Dennis Stone on. And that is one of the possible explanations of America's Stonehenge is things like that. Because, yeah, it would trace back to that time.
You know, they literally, according to the Weymouth journals, you know, that Scott's, I read both of the books. I've read everything on all of that. I've talked to Scott about it at length. And according to these journals, I mean, it really looks as if what they did, they left from Roslyn, you know,
Roslyn Chapel.
Yeah, anyway, from Roslyn through the islands, down through Iceland and Greenland, and then into the United States. But they actually had a plan. They brought the treasure in and hid it in several places in North America and sat on it until the War of Independence. And then that money, that's what funded the War of Independence.
Yep.
Was that money. So that plan, I mean, we're talking what, 400 or 500 years later after the demise of the Templars, that this plan actually, you know, came to fruition. And then we know that many of the first, you know, the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Masons, you know, and these Masons.
Yeah.
They're coming directly out of the Templar ideals, the same thing. Their ideals, their principles for Masonry were exactly the same. Well, not exactly, but very, very similar to the Templars. And we also know that if we look at the Weymouth journals, we see that there were actual Templar families that were hidden in Scotland for many, many years, and they were shipped into North America and stayed there. They integrated into the indigenous cultures, and they remained in North America. So they were actually, I think, you know, they were actually moving people into this continent long, long, long before it ever became, you know, America, United States of America.
That is fascinating to think about. That once again, because like you're saying, there is almost a good 500 year gap there.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking at hundreds of years. So this, my point is that the Templars never went away. They were never annihilated, you know, and I make this point over and over in my book, because that's what appeared to happen. That's what the Inquisition wanted everybody to believe. That's what, you know, the King Philip the Fair wanted everybody to believe, that they ended the Templars. But that's not reality. What reality was is they went into Portugal, they went into Scotland. They also remained in several other countries, as you'll see in the research in my book, embedded themselves in many, many other countries throughout Europe. And they continued with this agenda all the way up to, what, 400, almost 500 years later, when the United States of America, all of a sudden, here we have the United States of America, based on principles from the Magna Carta. Now, guess who co-authored the Magna Carta? Templars.
Wow.
Templars. And I found this out when I did my research in Hereford. I happened to be in Hereford when the Magna Carta, the real Magna Carta, was being shown at the Hereford Cathedral. So I did some back research and found out that indeed there were several Templars that were co-authored the Magna Carta, which was the document that was later used as a template for the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights.
Well, what connections do we have or can we show to actual Templar bloodline making its way to America? Do we have that?
I don't really know about actual Templar bloodlines making its way into the U.S., but I do know that I have met several Templars in Brazil that have direct bloodlines to Templars in Portugal.
And I guess the reasoning for asking that is, you know, how do we get to a point of that unbroken dream, that unbridled dream coming to be here in America? You know, how do we get to a point of that being transmitted? Because don't get me wrong, they were absolute masters at transmitting esoteric teaching and keeping that going, and keeping that going in secret, keeping that going with very few people having knowledge of it. But do we have any evidence that shows the fact that there was direct influence from, I guess, that manifest dream of the Templars and the free country in that kind of way to what we have and what became through the Revolution?
I don't think they ever let go. And as far as having direct evidence in terms of bloodlines, that would have been very dangerous, Chris. Mm. When I was doing my research in the Rosicrucian Library in San Jose, probably about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, it's been a while. And I finally purchased the book myself because it's that important. It was a very important research book, and it's called The Scarlet Book. And what it talks about in that book, each chapter is dedicated to a separate country where the Catholic Church, through the Jesuit order, went in and murdered anybody who was a Templar or that was suspected of as a Templar bloodline, a Mason. And this went on from the 15th century all the way up into the 18th century. And this was all through South America. This happened in Europe, and they went into India and did this. So they were hunting down anyone that they suspected was bloodline of Templar bloodline. Mm. So who's going to come forward and say,
yeah,
I'm a Templar and my bloodline goes back this far? Who's going to do that? You know what I'm saying? I can't think of anybody that's going to do that above board.
Yeah, that would be a tough go at that point. You know,
you bet it would. So, I mean, this was the same thing as with the bloodline of Jesus and Mary, you know, and the children, you know, that same bloodline has been hunted down for centuries.
Well, and once again, that esoteric knowledge itself of there being a lost bloodline, of there being remnant of Christ in the world, is a huge part of the Templar tradition, huge part of Rosicrucianism, all of those things.
Absolutely. And, you know, in all of these orders, you know, the Masons and the Rosicrucians, they all developed out of the ideals of the Templars, their principles. You see their principles in both of these orders, you know, and that is still, those are still practiced today. I mean, not to say that there aren't a lot of orders that kind of gotten off track, and I don't know if they really even understand the original agenda or mission, you know, but there are, that doesn't, I don't want to negate against the ones that are authentic and are altruistically still pursuing that agenda, that goal, that ultimate goal, to bring about a world of a higher consciousness, to bring about a world that has freedom of speech, freedom of religion, you know, equality for everyone. And, you know, and this is a Templar ideal. This is embedded and was embedded amongst the inner circle of the Templars all these years. This has gone on since, what, 1040, when they first organized the first members in Greece and then went into Constantinople. They had this ideal then. You know, this was something they wanted to bring about in the world at that point. And when you read my book, you'll find out that one of the reasons that they embedded themselves in all these countries in Europe was to raise the not the consciousness, but also raise the quality of living for the people around them. And you see this. They brought skills with them, farming. They taught animal husbandry. They taught, you know, they had herbal gardens. I see evidence of herbal gardens and numerous Templar, you know, right next to numerous Templar castles.
Well,
and this is also, you know, in Ireland. There's a wonderful researcher there in Ireland who's also found that evidence. But what my point is that they're, you know, they brought about a higher level of living in every single country in Europe. And most people don't understand. They don't realize this. When the Templars came into Europe in the early 12th century, we're talking about dark ages. I mean, these people were... they were destitute. There was constant bickering. There was no kings, you know, that were leaders of countries. There were small territories that battled constantly.
Yeah,
and this was going on. I mean, the lives of these people in medieval Europe were terrible. They were just terrible.
Yeah, it was all feudal lordships and things like that.
Right. And it was filthy. There was a lot of poverty. There was thievery. There was, you know, I mean, it was not a pleasant place. So what the Templars did in every single country they embedded themselves into was raise the level of living for the people around them, which influenced the people. You know how that goes, you know, exponentially, it goes out further and further and further. You know, your cousin lives over here. You tell your cousin tells his town folks. And next thing you know, you've got the quality of life raised in that area. So this is what they did quietly. You know, they had a tremendous amount of influence over the people that, you know, commoners and, you know, and monarchs and, you know, everyone alike, they influenced.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the things in like going into the next segment here in just a few minutes with about Royston Cave, Gretchen goes into is their Cistercian background, the background of them being Cistercian specifically and how the Cistercians are specifically connected with water. I mean, they came into places and, I mean, here it is talking about, you know, leets, canals, mill ponds, like all kinds of stuff. This was all stuff that they did in towns that they moved to, in towns that they came into. It was fascinating. The Cistercians were great with coming in, rehabbing a marshland, you know, things like, and growing things in it.
Right. They always went into the worst areas. If you look at the areas, you know, in history, they'll tell you they went into these deserted, rural, way out in the middle of nowhere areas.
Yeah.
And they just redeveloped, you know, they completely transformed these places, you know. And the other thing they did was they were trying to influence, you know, the Catholic Church and abolish corruption. That was one of the big things, you know, Bernard de Clairvaux, this was one of his primary missions that he wanted to accomplish. And of course, we we didn't see that fully, but I think he did influence hundreds, if not thousands, of people through just his beliefs and the way that he conducted himself and the way that he, you know, that he was involved in transforming all of the areas that he ever was located, you know, and anywhere he was, you see this development, bringing, you know, the quality of life up for all the inhabitants in those areas.
Yeah.
You know, this they shared, this Templar shared that with him. You know, this was something that they did as well. So.
Absolutely. And that's just it. It's one of those, it was especially in that monk aspect, as opposed to a typical knighthood or anything like that. You know, you have to remember that they are also monks, and that community aspect is a huge part of that religious life, not just living in community and supporting each other, but supporting the community around you and being an integral part of that community, not only worship wise, but whatever you can do to uplift the city health wise, whatever you can do to minister to the sick, the poor. These, especially at that point, with chivalric law, things like that with them, in addition to being monks, they were called to a different level of service to their common man.
And this was, you know, this had everything to do with the fact that their own beliefs, their own initiatory process, especially with the inner circle, that members that belong to the inner circle, they were extremely spiritually disciplined. You know, they walked their talk. You know, they didn't just... You know, they didn't just talk about that. They practiced these initiations. And some of these initiation processes went all the way back to, I'm sure, went back to Atlantean times, Lemurian times, you know, because they certainly went back as far as Egypt. And especially when they were studying in Egypt, when they went into Egypt and explored there and India, you know, India is one of the most ancient places on the planet. And they were, you know, they were bringing back all this esoteric knowledge. So, and they were utilizing it. They just didn't put it on a shelf somewhere. You know, they were utilizing it. You know, if you talk to Timothy Hogan, you know, he'll tell you they actually did initiation processes in Istanbul, which is now Istanbul, which was then Constantinople, under the Druze, which was a very ancient spiritual, you know, belief system. So, you know, so these are the things that they were literally practicing themselves. And, you know, Hamilton White, who's a close friend of mine, he has some pieces that are phenomenal showing two Templar knights with a ceremonial chalice between them, you know, praying on their knees, praying. So it shows that these initiation symbols, these and chalices and things, they were actually being utilized by the Templars, especially in Tomar. This is where this cache that Hamilton has was discovered in the 1960s, was in Tomar. It was dug up in Tomar, which, of course, we know was the headquarters of the Templars in Portugal. Yeah. So, and you wait to... I'll be showing several of these relics in episode 3, and I'm so excited because these are phenomenal. This collection that he has is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, and you know, when you start looking at once again the artifacts like that connect these things, that bring these things to light, when you start looking at all of the connections overseas to Brazil, like you said, direct bloodline people from Templar families, things like that over there. It really does. And even the bringing of esoteric knowledge from the Ottoman Empire beyond to India, to Greece, all of these older esoteric traditions open you to a different concept of what that good and evil is, of how to connect with things, of even the fact that most Templar churches are based off of the Temple of Solomon. I mean, granted, most cathedrals are built off of the dimensions of the Temple of Solomon.
Several of them are, yes. Yeah. Several of them are. And that's, you know, that's another fascinating concept. So, you know, it sort of insinuates that they wanted to build new Jerusalems,
yeah.
Plural,
yeah,
in numerous places. So, you know, it's an indication of that. And Royston is also indirectly an indication of the Templars, you know, being beyond 1314, because many of the inscriptions are attributed to the 16th century and the 17th century, right? So Gretchen has all the dates on all that. But
yeah.
But what it implies, what most people don't even think about, is it implies an ongoing
tradition.
You know, yeah. Tradition that members of the Templars were still making these marks in that cave. Right?
Yeah.
So it's another implication that Templars were still alive and still practicing and still carrying their agenda and their, you know, initiatory practices yeah. forward. Because I firmly believe when I was in Royston cave, I believe it was used as an initiation chamber. The acoustics in there are phenomenal. I mean, I played with that a little bit while I was there. You know, the guide wasn't too happy with me, but I just did a few vowels.
So yeah.
I didn't do a lot. But the acoustics in there are phenomenal, you know. So I had no doubt that it was used as an initiation chamber.
Yeah. And the carvings on the wall, we'll be getting into this in the next segment with her.
Yeah.
And for those that aren't aware, just so you know, folks, the second guest is always pre-recorded. So on occasion, you'll hear me reference the segment coming up in that kind of way, because the first guest is live. If we go long, then we don't have a guest waiting for us to connect because the conversation is good. And if the second guest goes long, it goes long. It's great. There are some interesting things that we get into with the carvings. There is some great new data that she came up with the carvings that is absolutely awesome.
She's done some phenomenal research. I wrote some things for her book because when I read that research, she's really done some phenomenal research for that book.
Yeah.
You know, my hat is off to her big time with that.
She
really delved in some things that, you know, that I completely missed while I was in there. I was looking for one thing and she was looking for something else. You know, I was looking for crosses. I was looking for initiation symbols to show the continuity of the Templars, you know. And I'll let her get into that. But I was just really, you know, I was really jazzed when I read her book.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just the idea of once again, carrying along those esoteric traditions, moving those things along not just familial lines, but philosophic lines, and taking on new students and passing it on, even if it is in secret and the fact that it's not in public display. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's right there on the walls in Royston. Yep. There's narrative in there. You know, if you read Gretchen's book, well, I mean, there's literally a story in
there. It's in stained glass, too, you know, and like, you know, more than anybody an artist of the physical medium in that kind of way.
And we have it again on the side of San Leonardo Church.
We
have an entire altar, dedicated to the Holy Family.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are, they're there for us to discover. We just have to get out there, boots on the ground, and find them.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because, and I should have talked to you more over the last year. Literally, I was part of an amazing experience, the Sistine Chapel experience here in Austin.
Wow. Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was great. It was a technical challenge. It was a projected atmosphere, bringing the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and the panels down to working height. So instead of being like the traditional one that was set up in Poland was full scale, like you were walking into Sistine Chapel. They allowed them to go in for 16 nights and high-res scan the place, all kinds of, like, it's an authorized Vatican experience. It was pretty cool.
I can imagine. I've been in the Sistine Chapel.
It's one of the most incredible places in the world. And to see it at basically at the height that he would have been at scaffolding, where it was like 15 feet away from David.
Wow.
You know, I mean, seeing it on scale is pretty massive. It's pretty cool.
Well, that's the scale that Michelangelo, you know. That's where he saw it.
But that's just it. There is so much hidden in those panels. There is so much. I mean, to the point that even the guy who worked for the Pope, who said that he'd never get it done, like Leonardo painted him with a donkey head.
Yeah.
And threw him in there. Like there are all these little deep cuts that are inside of there that an artist does. All these tiny little things. And one of my favorites is in The Last Judgment, in the panel of The Last Judgment, and I'll bring it up as you talk here, as somebody that is a doctor in art, things like that. I see it referred to so many times. It's like, oh, look at the Nephilim in The Last Judgment. And it's a twisted guy in a cave. And it's like, no, these are the twisted souls that are not in the Book of Life. And it's like, you are fully misinterpreting this. And I can tell you why. Because Michelangelo told us what he meant when he painted it. Like, he explained it to the Pope. There are scrolls and stuff. Like, he told us what every panel meant and why he painted it and why he put it there. So there's no question that, like, this is not the Nephilim. It's not Bigfoot. It's not anything like that. It's exactly what Michelangelo, the artist himself, told us it was. There's zero need for interpretation when the artist tells you what it is.
Exactly. Exactly.
But when you're talking about
Leonardo was a little bit more sneaky, you know. Yes. He's got some stuff in his work that is unbelievable that we're just now discovering.
Well, and that's just it. He was
Robert Edward Grant has taken apart Da Vinci's stuff, and you got to look him up if you get a chance. Robert Edward Grant took the Vitruvian Man. Well, actually, it was Alan Green that first discovered it, that the actual circle that Leonardo did to create the Vitruvian Man is off by a fraction of an inch. And it's intentional because Robert Edward Grant took that measurement and multiplied it into the human body. And it shows where all the chakras are in the human body. And then he multiplied those numbers. And I'm not real good with math, but he multiplied those numbers and realized that it showed where all of the in the Great Pyramid, where all the areas, all the hollow areas are in the Great Pyramid, that the Great Pyramid has a chakra system. Mm. Check out Robert Edward Grant's stuff.
I will look into it.
I was fascinated with this.
And here's the picture I was talking about that everybody always says is like a Bigfoot or a fall. And it's like, no, these are the twisted souls that did not make it into the Book of Life, into the very tiny book. There was a big, big Book of the Damned that all these dudes are in, and then a very tiny Book of Life that these guys are not in. Yeah, it's fascinating. When you start looking at esoteria to begin with, and the example that I normally give, which ties directly to Knights Templar, we've talked with Gretchen Cornwall about this, is the tarot.
And I believe that this time that we're living in right now, Chris, is the time when all these secrets are to be revealed. You know, Timothy Hogan revealing secrets that have been held tight-lipped by the Templars for hundreds of years. He's now disclosing some phenomenal stuff that would have never been shared 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago. So these secrets are coming out, you know, and researchers like myself, like Gretchen, like, you know, all of us that are involved in this field are finding things. Look at Göbekli Tepe, you know, Karahan Tepe. Look at all these places that have come to light that the whole entire world gets to know about. You know, this is common knowledge now throughout the whole entire globe. Everybody knows about these discoveries. There's no secrets.
Yeah.
The secrets are being uncovered. They're being unearthed, literally unearthed and given to us. The truth is being revealed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good people like yourself. It's good people like Gretchen that are out there in the field, looking this stuff up, spending the time digging and digging and digging through histories and chronicles in,
right,
in national libraries, things like that, digging through,
right,
other alternative histories that have been dug up. So kudos to, right, you and your great work. I cannot wait for the new book. Yeah. Let everybody know where they can go to follow all your work, where they can go to tune in for, well, hopefully episode 2 release here in America, here in the Western, him or in the United States, as well as episode 3 of Templars, yeah, in Brazil. So let everybody know.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing episode 2 back into the United States.
Awesome.
As soon as we possibly can. And episode 3 is going to debut in Galway, England, when I do my lecture there on October 19th.
Oh, so, great.
Or 18th. I think it's the 18th, actually. Anyway, when I do that, and then it'll later premiere here in Sedona, Arizona, sometime next year. But in the meantime, we're going to try. We're going to pull episode 2 back out of the other countries where it's being shown right now, and we have to make some changes in order to get it onto American television. So
yeah,
working on that over the next 6 months.
Well, Godspeed on all that, as always, my friend. And as soon as it happens, get with me, because
I definitely will.
As with Gretchen, it's been way too long. So let's definitely keep in touch. All right.
Oh, absolutely, Chris. Absolutely.
Well, great talking to you as always. We'll be sending links. Take care.
Okay, doke. Yeah, I'll send you all the links to everything once once I get everything, and then we can, you know, maybe we'll do another episode later when I get back from the UK, or after we get after the first of the year or something.
Oh, we will
when we get episode 2 back.
Sounds good. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Say hi to Gretchen for me, will you?
You bet.
Okay. Have a great night, you both of you.
All right. Take care, hon.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Man, it is always great catching up with Kathleen Ball, and her work is, once again, spans such a huge breadth of everything from the Templars leaving France to going to Portugal to Brazil to how they once again came to founding America and moved forward in that manifest destiny vision that they had. That's a horrible phrasing for that, but you know what I mean. Anyway, when we come back from this quick break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend Gretchen Cornwall. We will be talking about her exciting new book, The Curse of Oak Island's Templar Cave Royston, what the carvings mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine, all kinds of fun things with Gretchen Cornwall right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying with us. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, everybody, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part. That's seeds, stems, buds, roots, everything. Every part is used, combusted, and reused until nothing but an amazing spigeric product remains, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Choose a product that works right for you and use the code CURIOUS7 to get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Gretchen Cornwall. Her new book, there it is. Her new book just came out, Templar Cave, Royston. This is The Curse of Oak Island's Templar Cave. We have had Gretchen on before discussing this topic. She was on The Curse of Oak Island many years ago, actually, discussing it. The first Royston episode that happened came because of your work and your work into Zena Halpern's map. So welcome back to the show, Gretchen. You have been on a tear of writing amazing books this year. So congratulations on the great new research.
Thank you.
Let's get into the book and what some of your findings at Royston Cave are specifically, Gretchen.
Ah, thank you. Royston is so complex. It is an onion, if that might be a cliche. But I realized through my work with The Curse of Oak Island, my research into House Rochefoucauld, I went to their chateau, the great Doug Kroll of The Curse of Oak Island broached that subject, and I thought I must go. And what I found there astonished me. And I applied that information to Royston Cave when I realized what I was looking at. I also used my background as a historically themed wedding dress designer. And of course, when one studies history, you have to absorb the customs of the day. So it was truly a multidisciplinary approach that led me to understand the carvings I was looking at. And there are very few books out about Royston. It was discovered in 1742. There are very few books out, and I think there are about 12, and I'm two of them. So a true discovery is the holy grail for writers like myself, seekers like myself. I am always on a quest because it explains who I am. And Christopher, I know you're the same. But when I realized what I was looking at in two particular carvings, and there have been other discoveries as well, and I've done a complete survey on the cave. Some things have been known and agreed on by academics over the few centuries. Other things have been left in argument, but no one has pegged this particular carving. If I dare say it, Excalibur, and also given greater meaning to the date of 1347, the brick. But I have created a PowerPoint for you if you are
please
keen to see it. Let's see if I can remember how to do this here, but yes, when I realized what I was looking at in the mermaid carving, I just about fell off my chair. And it was such an exciting exciting moment for me as a writer. How are you doing? Can you see what's happening? So you can see my screen, etc. So let's see here, pop onto another screen. So Royston Cave is an underground chamber, a bell-shaped, and it's beneath a ancient crossroads, which is fascinating in itself. It's deep beneath the earth. It's 8 meters tall, 26 feet tall. There's only one way into this thing until tourism took over. It is an interesting crossroads, ancient crossroads, rediscovered in 1742, covered with dense, dizzying carvings meant to jog you out of your daily life. It's a bit like going to see an intense movie or being surrounded by a new story that is actually heretical during this day and age, where you could be at least socially ostracized and economically at worst, you might experiencing something more deadly. So 1742, it's accidentally discovered when workmen decide to build a bench just in the right place. I do not believe this discovery story. I believe that within generations three, and I hope I'll remember to encapsulate this at the end, within three generations, knowledge was closed at the beginning of the English Civil War because they didn't want it damaged, and its secret was kept by strict memorization. And when it was deemed safe and people had passed, times had passed, and the antiquarian world of research had fully opened up, they removed the millstone, which sealed the only entrance, and lowered themselves down into the cave. So this is a descent into the underworld. There's only one way in. They found a human skull. We don't know where it is now. They found buried carvings. Why bury the carvings? Because they told a dangerous story. So you'll see on the right a very old dissection of the cave and my reinterpretation in the center. Sorry about that. So above ground at this ancient crossroads, guess what? You would have had the town of Royston populated by Templar Knights, even though they only, by rumor, owned three properties. Mm. The Augustinians actually owned the church at the crossroads. Now, the crossroads is the ancient Icknield Way, Celtic Way, and the north-south route is Roman, going from London up to York. And this is a pivotal place. So you get the London Templar headquarters 50 miles south of Royston, and this is the highway in and out of London via the north. So the headquarters wanted to know what's going on. The Templars actually wanted this land, wanted this point in the landscape, but it was given to the Augustinians. But curiously enough, going back in time, even prior to the Augustinians taking over the crossroads, some individual, a local nobleman, started an independent church there dedicated to Saint John the Baptist. I believe, and this is just my inference, that this individual had Templar leanings and may have even been connected to a structure that we're going to talk about very soon here. But this is what you would have encountered at the crossroads. There would have been some kind of a dwelling, some kind of a building where the oculus opening of Royston Cave could have been protected, and they would have been changing money, selling market goods there. This was a royal market town. You could only have a market town by royal decree. the Templars were given land 8 miles south of here and kind of offside. And so it was an 8 mile road for them to get to Royston. But their church was dedicated to Mary Magdalene. Now, the interesting thing about this is so you've got the dedication of John the Baptist, which is the Templar patron saint, and you've also got Mary Magdalene nearby. So Baldock, where the Templars planted their flag, is a derivative of Baghdad. And the area around that is filled with quirky little names like Moor, names that you would expect to come out of the Middle East, which is really intriguing. So this structure you see here is what might have been available at the time, right at one of the most important crossroads out of London leading north. So spycraft, who's coming in, who's going out? Yes, they're dealing with pilgrims, and yes, they're having sacred initiation, ceremonies, prayer, etc. going on. So next. Now, the interesting thing about this is on the Icknield Way heading northeast, not far, is Cambridge Round Church. So Royston Cave is round, and also so is Cambridge Round Church. One of the things that drew the Curse of Oak Island to me was the fact that this structure was round. The Money Pit, legend has it, of course, everybody who watches Oak Island knows this, the legendary Money Pit is circular and is divided by platforms every 10 feet. Yeah. It's as much ceremonial as it is structural. So here you have another round structure. So the cave sits within a purposeful landscape. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built around 1130 by a mysterious fraternity that disappears kind of soon afterwards. The website for Cambridge here said at one point they believed it was built by Templars. I think they took that down. Now, it's always really difficult to prove anything. But if you were trying to prove a murder case, would you walk past the usual suspects hoping something else would land in your lap? Of course you wouldn't. You would chase down what's in front of you, wouldn't you?
Well, and Hugh de Payen definitely had connections with the Holy Sepulchre.
Yes, he was in, he was, his boots were on the ground.
Yeah.
His upline, who he worked for, the Count of Champagne, managed to score, goodness, it's just phenomenal. What untried order of nine men gets one of the most prized real estate locations to start their order and uses as stables right next to the King of Jerusalem's palace? It doesn't happen. And that's because Hugh de Payen was connected to Bernard de Clairvaux, one of the most influential movers and shakers of the, you know, the 1120s, you know, etc., who masterminded the Templars with Hugh de Payen. And then when the order was official, the Count of Champagne gives up all his lands and then cedes the position to Hugh de Payen. So under what feudal world does an underling become in charge of his liege lord?
Well, yeah, and 1129 is actively when they came under Benedictine tradition. Before then, they were Augustinian.
Forgive me. So basically, Hugh de Payen was swore an oath to the King of Jerusalem to help stabilize the security threat. There were only 300 or so protectors of Jerusalem when Hugh de Payen stepped into the field. So they received a great boon in around 1120, and then after I might be getting this wrong, 9 years of hard graft of actually helping to protect the port of Jaffa on the Mediterranean coast to Jerusalem. It was dangerous. It was rocky. It was hilly. It was being patrolled by local Bedouin bandits, if one, it's their native land, so yeah. It's hard to call them bandits, but the whole area was littered with the dead of pilgrims, rich or poor. So getting from the coast off a boat to Jerusalem was tough. So once a certain amount of success had been achieved, then Hugh de Payen and the mysterious Count of Champagne went back to France, met with Bernard de Clairvaux. That's when they received the rule.
Yes, the
and
Latin
signed
rule.
Up as yeah, and yeah. signed up as Cistercians with swords.
Yes,
to put it bluntly.
Yeah.
So
that began
and you're right.
That separation really of the military monastic and the Augustinian tradition. In that way.
So the Augustinians actually weren't part of that, but the hospitalers were sort of hedging their bets that way. But the Templars really were at the forefront of being monks with swords, and then the hospitalers formalized. But the Augustinians were constantly in conflict with the Templars at the crossroads of Ermine and the Icknield Way.
Well, yeah,
they did not want the Templars there at all.
Exactly. And that's just it. That like they came from a fully monastic order originally, which is what I mean by the Augustinian tradition in that kind of way, where they were fully monastic. And then they adopted the Latin rule, and that's when things became militaristic and monastic.
Right.
So.
Right. It's such a fascinating topic.
Exactly.
And they were well respected. They were the rock stars, captured on film and forever young. And here we are talking about them centuries later.
The construction of Royston Cave, though, the structure that you had on screen where you can see a cutaway view of it. Reminds me very much of like the Byzantine cone houses and things like that that exist in the Middle East.
I brought that to the war room in I think it might have been 2019. It took 4 years to get them to film at Royston Cave. But yes, you're spot on. And this is a memory of those caves. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. The Holy Sepulchre. Oh, thank you for bringing that
up.
There it is. And of course, the bee was very important to their life as well. And the bee creates a honeycomb of geometry in nature. And also, you have the queen bee. So Bernard was very particular about starting the Mariology movement. He had a very close relationship with Mary Magdalene. He gave his crozier to Spire Cathedral, dedicated to her. And Hugh de Payen was his partner in crime, starting the Templar Order. Brilliant, brilliant man. I wish we knew more about him. We can extrapolate. Yeah. But this structure is a holy structure, and the Cambridge Round Church is the as above, so below. So you get the above ground, and then you get the below ground. What can be expressed in daylight? What cannot be expressed? For many reasons. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head, with that. And of course, the octagonal structure is very important. That is a feature in the book. I won't discuss it here. I'm going to bring up a lot of things today, and you'll have to pick up the book to find out more about why the octagon is so important here. Do you have any questions before I go further here?
No, please go ahead and continue.
Whoops. Okay, so now Royston is complex. I believe I have pegged this correctly. There are some really interesting reasons why this is a layered structure, and I've made it a study. I know a great deal about the medieval man-made structures in the UK. I have been I've served two terms as a on the board of trustees for the Margate Shell Grotto Friends Trust. I know that thing inside and out. I've been privy to surveys, scientific surveys, two of them. I lived down the street from that structure. It's chalk. Royston Cave is also carved out of chalk, and because of that geology, it has a particular kind of history to it. What is a dean hole? A dean hole is a pit that is dug for chalk used in creating plaster for building. And Royston was a booming town. And we'll get to more of that. So what you want to do when you're creating a sacred space to keep it a secret is you dig it out publicly. You dig the chalk out publicly, but you've got the place pegged down and you've got the floor plan designed as already too. So and then you sell the fruits of your digging, don't you? You know. So in the 1140s, so much was happening. Lady Roysia de Vere, she comes from a Norman family who conquered England with William the Conqueror in 1066. So in 1066, the Anglo-Saxon nobility was completely pushed out. French became the language. And William the Conqueror was building castles all over the place. So Lady Roysia de Vere is a newcomer to the landscape. And very famous name, de Vere. She marries Geoffrey de Mandeville, who is an incredible individual. So going further forward, after their deaths, you have Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is a one of the most powerful individuals in Europe, let alone powerful women in Europe. She's the catch, and everybody, you know, all of the kings wanted to be married to this woman. I believe she was the secular partner to Bernard de Clairvaux. She rode on the Second Crusade at his behest. Now, she sponsored the Troubadour movement, which was about chivalric love and Arthurian lore. And he tackled, on the religious side, Mariology. So going forward, now she dies in 1204. By this time, Lady Roysia de Vere had passed, you know, by, she falls off the records, I think, at 1170 when she witnesses her third son, being elevated to a new status, but she falls off the records after that. And this is important going forward. You've got to, when you're studying a location, who was around at the time? Who was wearing what? What was the armor like? What was the artwork like? You have to take all of these things into consideration. Was there war? Was there prosperity? What do the primary and secondary sources say? So going forward, you also have an amazing individual, Edward III, one of my favorite kings, incredibly interesting individual. And then you get the Freemason generation and James VI of Scotland and one of England takes over the town of Royston. And I believe he was down there, and there are some indications as to his presence there. Now, do you have any thoughts before I go forward, or shall I plow forward onward here?
Oh, no, no. Let's plow onward so that we can start getting into the carvings in the cave, things like that,
yeah.
What their connections are.
So on the lower left, you'll see me standing next to what is left of a high status, expensive object. And that is Lady Roisia's cross, or Rohes, or Rohesia. Literally, her name means rose. So this thing is massive, and it contained a very large cross. History records it as a humble wayside finder, but why would anybody want to do that? I believe at this juncture, this town was booming, and she wanted to stamp her mark on it. But more than that, this cross, I believe, is a memorial to Geoffrey de Mandeville, her husband, because he was ruthlessly killed in battle. Mm-hmm. It marks the beginning of Royston Cave. So Geoffrey de Mandeville rebels against King Stephen, who was not supposed to inherit the crown. When Henry I died without a male heir, he wanted Matilde to take over the crown. Matilde had been an experienced empress and in Europe and Germany. Her husband died. So he calls her back to England and says, I want you to be queen. So Stephen, her first cousin, says, no way am I having that, manages to basically be a complete bully. And then 30 years of a war of attrition, no rules, complete horrific slaughter on either side ensues. But she gets the last laugh and her son becomes king. Geoffrey de Mandeville switches sides and decides to be loyal to Matilde. He dies in battle. But the problem is King Stephen managed to get him excommunicated, so he can't be buried on a church ground. So what do you do with his body? Well, the Templars take his body. This guy was important to them. His effigy is in Temple Church, London, just down the street from Royston, and he's actually interred somewhere on that property. Because it was such a sticky subject, they quietly took his body, took custody of it, and I believe he was killed in mid-September. And they had to process his body down to the Templar headquarters here. So I think that he was interred in a shrine in Royston Cave, but the carvings weren't there yet, and that cross was up so Lady Roisia could memorialize her husband. And that's not an uncommon thing, to have way crosses to mark the burial procession of an important loved one. So hopefully I haven't gone too much on that one. But the Templars even had to leave this poor man hanging in a tree for 3 years.
Oh my.
Above church ground, because so hot a potato was he. They didn't want to risk the wrath of the church or the wrath of the king. Okay, so I talked about the anarchy already, so I'll blow past that. So the reason why I say there weren't any carvings at that juncture is because I know when the carvings at least started. And that's at the death of Eleanor of Aquitaine. She passes in 1204. But what happens is that she leaves instructions on how she wants her effigy to appear in Fontevraud Abbey. And every image we have of her after that point, we have no other images of her except for her effigy. And you'll see in the middle here, I took this photo. This is a plaster reproduction in London of what it originally looked like. The original in Fontevraud Abbey is a bit damaged now, but this is the original that those wonderful Victorians managed to score before war damage hit. So you can see this tall, kind of ridiculous looking crown, but she's in an active pose of reading. She wants to be remembered as attractive and tall and slim and youthful. And guess what? Today, all women are beautiful. All women are queens and princesses, and we celebrate your inner, you know, royal, your inner divinity. But you go back to that time period, you'll get arrested for it. You might even lose your life. So there are, how to delicately say this, now, Royston Cave is a known quantity in the UK, not exactly a secret, but it was a privilege to bring Royston Cave to a greater international audience in 2022. And since then, it's become quite popular with other researchers and authors. And unfortunately, a few have tried to bend my discoveries into something it never was. So you cannot say that this carving, which has always been identified with Eleanor of Aquitaine, undisputed because of her effigy, nobody has ever disputed that this is Eleanor. However, there is talk out there by some very, you know, famous individuals who are saying that this is Lady Royzie de Vere. She was never anything other than a lower tier lady, a woman of nobility, important nobility, but she was not a queen. And the structure of hierarchy at that time was royalty, king and queen, you got to wear the ermine, you got to wear the gold, you got to wear the jewels, and the lower down the totem pole you are, it was measured how much gold you could wear. And you get to a rank where you're baronial, for example, and you can wear copper, maybe a little bit of gold leaf, but everything's measured. So there's no way this carving is Lady Royzie de Vere. And here is the crown right there. And it gets deeper than that, because on her maternal side, this woman is so powerful. She got a lot of her money and her wealth from being a Rochefoucauld, which was very important to the story of the Curse of Oak Island for a very long time, and filled me with inspiration. And I went to Chateau de la Rochefoucauld. Their family crest is Melusine, a shape-shifting mermaid and a dragon. And that is the family crest for the Rochefoucauld family, and Eleanor is a Rochefoucauld. So what you've got here is, in the medieval world, you would never have a woman accentuate her ankles. It's obscene. There's no way that's going to happen. None of the other women in the cave are depicted in that manner. They're all wearing straight dresses with a belt. There's no argument as to whether or not these women are women, and she's the only one in the cave that is depicted as her ancestor, if you will, of mystery, Melusine, the Lady of the Lake. So you can see she is a mermaid. Her tail starts here, spills out over the alcove in this rather decorative fashion. So this is a mermaid we're looking at. We're looking at Melusine, Eleanor of Aquitaine as Melusine, and she was Queen of England, and she lived in England. She was the Queen of England, and her famous son, Richard the Lionheart, you know, carried the tradition forward, and it went down saying, you know, he sprang from evil. So, you know, it's really interesting. I think he had some fun with that, because this whole Rochefoucauld and Lusignan family line is a bit heretical. And the reason why, so long story short, Melusine tells her husband, yes, I will marry you, but you cannot come into my chamber on Saturday So a jealous brother says, hey, are you sure you know what she's doing in there on Saturdays? They've had 10 kids by that time, 10 sons. He gets a little bit insecure. He spies on her. And Melusine, his bride of many years, this incredibly talented woman who can raise castles in no short order. She can raise churches quickly. She heals. She's creative. She's beautiful. Everyone wants to be related to her, know her, etc. She's a mermaid in her bath on Saturdays. So she is the Fisher Queen. And what is the problem with that on Saturday? Well, we're talking about the Jewish day of rest, the Jewish Sabbath. Christianity takes their day of rest on Sundays. So she realizes she's been rumbled. She, in alarm and great fear, turns into a dragon, flies away, never to be seen again. And this is your dragon lineage across Europe. Your Pendragon, Head Dragon, Order of the Dragon. And again, it's all tied to Camelot and the Fisher Kings, Fisher Queens. It's quite an amazing subject. But to be likened to this mermaid, to the dragon, is all about the hierarchy. You're not a fish. You're a mermaid, you're a dragon, and you are swimming in the invisible planes and fairy realms, if you will. So I'll blast forward here. Interestingly enough, quickly, Melusine was supposedly, you know, only related to House Lusignan. And the Lusignan Tower of the castle still stands, and she is supposedly flying around the tower to warn her descendants there's danger. She cries out in the night, and it's her tower, the Melusine's tower. Well, Magdalene means tower. So it gets interesting there. So I'll drop that one on you. So Eleanor of Aquitaine, maternal power, Pendragon, Arthurian lore, evil or character assassination. And here you have Melusine in her dragon form on Chateau de la Rochefoucauld. This is Eleanor, a drawing of her. This is a very old drawing. Next to her, you have John the Baptist, and you have the Archbishop of Canterbury. And she had a bit of a run-in with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, who unfortunately met his end by Eleanor's husband, Henry II, when he unfortunately said, will somebody rid me of this priest? And of course, four of his knights did so. And those individuals more than likely got sent off to the Holy Land to serve as Templars. We know two of them did. The interesting thing about that is that Henry II had to pay the wages and support for 200 Templars in the Holy Land for a year because of this incident. That's how important the Canterbury carving is next to Eleanor on the walls of the cave. So going forward, forgive me. This is my photograph of Chateau de la Rochefoucauld. Next to this is a stained glass window in the chapel on the castle grounds for the family, their private chapel. This is Mary Magdalene holding the grail, looking rather pregnant, I might say. So I'll leave you with that. I was granted an audience. I was too scared to ask for a selfie. I wish I'd had the guts to do it, but I spoke with the Duchess, Sonia Matossian. Tiny lady, ferocious. She guards her family and her family's inheritance quite with great pride, and rightfully so. And she said wonderfully that the Lusignans were just simply lucky enough to write it down first that Melusine was their ancestress. Mm. So she was quite ready to take over that narrative. Briefly, this is a little bit out of shape, and this image is in the book. But some of you may be familiar with dowsing, the Michael and Mary line. Well, it culminates as a vortex in Royston Cave. But I've also included other locations on this. This is a map that other people might recognize in its black and white illustrated form. I don't have time to bring it up here, but it's in the book. But you'll see Melusine crouched there. But you've also got the Uffington horse. The Uffington horse is really important because there's when you're going down that chalk ridge all the way down to Bristol, the port of Bristol in the southwest had a strong Templar presence, and the Uffington horse is in Royston Cave. Briefly, this is, forgive me, I don't know how much time I have with you here, Christopher.
That's okay, go.
This is the map that started it all. Whatever you think about it, it is controversial, but we all love to talk about it. Zena Halpern, bless her. Rochefoucauld is the name in the top right corner. I'm looking forward to talking more about this map here in the near future. I've done a lot of research on this, particularly the lower right-hand corner of this map. In short, I was interviewed twice for the lower right-hand corner of the map in 2019. Neither episode aired, which has always been a disappointment to me. But I've done a lot of research since then. I can't wait to update you on that. So that will be coming soon, too. So you've got Chateau de la Rochefoucauld, the Rochefoucauld name up here. But down here in long form, you have what amounts to the date of 1347.
Yep.
Now, there's a brick in the cave that's very hard to see, 1347. Now, that ties in with Edward III, because the concept for the Order of the Garter, which was based in chivalry, shame on him who thinks evil of it as the motto, he rescues the honor of potentially his mistress, who, as the story goes, during a feast, her garter falls off her thigh during a dance. He swoops down, because this is so horrendously embarrassing, that he puts it on his leg and says, shame on you for thinking that this is an embarrassment. And to this day, the garter is the image of this Arthurian inspired most powerful order in the world still, with its members for life, 24 of them. So you've got Edward III's Arthurian revival in 1348 officially, but the groundwork gets laid for it in 1347. And the St. George is in the cave, and of St. George is the patron saint of the order. His colors are white with a red cross. And of course, that bespeaks of the Templars. Now, but didn't the church and everything was written down in Latin? But right? So how could that brick possibly have been carved in 1347? Maybe it was a memorial postdated to 1347. Mm. Maybe it was carved in 1347. It's dangerous to say either. But what's fun is if you look at Pope Sylvester II, he was such an intelligent individual. He did not reign very long, but he was quite taken with the Hindu Arabic numerical system. And he did influence the church at that time to start using it. And both of these systems were used in tandem. And you can't very well have 1347 in long form written here, can you? It's possible. I'm not saying yes or no, but there is a precedent for it. Mm. So going forward, here is a very awkward looking carving. This has been surmised for some time as two knights, the seal of the Templar Knight Order. The horse is gone, but you still have two individuals very close. There's a crescent moon nearby as well, next to this, which gives greater credence that these are Templars. And below it on the ground is a initiatory ceremonial tomb, if you will, where one would lay for 3 days. And of course, to copy Christ, you rise into your new life on the third day. So here you are, you've got this chamber that you immerse yourself in. Thank you, Christopher, for finding the virtual reality, which is wonderful.
Oh, this is one of my favorite things in the world, is this virtual reality tour of Royston Cave.
I wasn't sure whether or not I should do that, if they would be concerned about it or not. But thank you for bringing it up.
I'll be the one to do it. That's on me, Royston, if you want to have a problem with it.
Okay. I wasn't sure if that was the right thing to do or not. So I thank you for doing that. But, there's some incredibly important things going on in here. Initially, you would have had, a very low wooden ceiling, which was carved in, if you will, designed to look like, the Star of, David, the six-pointed star. I know that sounds strange. Pick up the book to see how that is possible. So the lower carvings, there's a demarcation line. You can clearly see where they end and where the wooden platform had been. So you would have come down the oculus by some kind of like a rope ladder onto that platform, and on that platform might have been storage goods that were being sold at the market. There would have been a hatch, and then you would have gone down into this holy chamber where your life is going to change. And you would have been shown by candlelight, and you would have been shown through active prayer and meditation, quite severe, strict meditation practices. And you would have learned the secrets of the Knights Templar and Templarism, which continued through, I believe, into Freemasonry and especially Rosicrucians. So on we go. Now, this is a great, this is called the High Altar in Royston. You'll see an array of carvings here. This was in the late 30s, an interesting image where pick up the book. You end up with a illuminated manuscript that shows a crowned figure of King David of the Psalms 69, beseeching God, please have mercy on me. And he's holding his arms up because the tide is rising and he's going to drown. So the other interesting thing about this is this is recognizable to Freemasons.
Yes.
But it's also a pattern I have seen starting with Hildegard Herod of Landsberg's, frontispiece to the Garden of Delights, which is basically a manual to her nuns in the future on how to run an abbey. And Herod of Landsberg, I believe, was venerating Mary Magdalene as Cassiopeia, as the Queen of Heaven, and she revolves around the North Star, which is Jesus. And that's not the only image I have found where artists and cartographers are venerating Mary Magdalene as the W and the M, because it revolves in the night sky. So you get this broad W. So there you have it with King David.
And oddly, with the figure with his arms up, I don't think I'd ever noticed that he was making the hooked horns, the sign of the evil eye.
Are you talking about his hand here on the left?
Yeah.
That's difficult because this cave has suffered so much damage. There's such high humidity in there. People have been coming down there since 1742 and scrawling their little initials all over it.
True,
you know,
true.
You might be right. And I'm not going to say no to that. And I can't wait to go back and verify what you just said.
Here it is a little bit closer. So, I mean, you can kind of see the top of the fingers.
Awesome. Now, maybe if they were full hand gesture to begin with, maybe somebody destroyed it on purpose to get that image
could
across
be.
That.
But it is,
you know, that could be done. Yeah.
But it is interesting that it lies right next to what they called the pagan symbols. You know,
this is a distraction. So you get the horse, the very upright horse. That's the Huffington.
Yeah.
Huffington horse, who is quite pronounced and quite proud and quite there. You got it. Yeah. The Huffington horse didn't really look like that at one point. It looked more like a horse. But, you know, so that's an eyewitness account of the Huffington horse. And you've got your Sheila Nagig. So the medieval world was quite raw, quite basic. Everyone lived close to the land. And also, even, you know, it didn't matter what church it was, the Sheila Nagig was often present along with the Green Man. There are dozens of green men in Canterbury Cathedral, which most people don't have access to because it's up in the upper galleries, which are closed to people. Whoops, did I do that? Oh, so anyway, I think that's a shocking distraction, and it's there on purpose. Yes, it's real, but what's next to it matters more. The two swords. So the upright sword they discovered in an earlier survey, when this was properly assessed, this had been painted red. So you get this fiery appearance of a fiery sword, and you get almost this egg-like pommel here. So this was painted red at one point. And you get this interesting, I discovered this. This is a compass. It is a working compass. It represents locations encoded in the landscape and also time, dates encoded in the landscape. I will drop this. It cuts all the way across to Portugal, to Lisbon. Portugal.
Wow.
And England have had the longest running alliance in the world. When it well over 700 years. So this is a geomantic marker, and they wanted to hide that. So what do? You shock people by putting, you know, something X-rated next to it. But it's still important because you don't perpetuate a bloodline. And right above it, I didn't show it in its entirety, but you have a couple. The Holy Family is what this is called. What Holy Family? It's the next generation. So mom and dad perpetuate their bloodline, the king of the political king of Jerusalem had there not been an occupation by Rome at the time. So you've got Mary Magdalene, the next generation, and with the question mark hanging over the Rochefoucaulds and the Lusignans, the Merovingians, etc. But this is a working compass. This has been deemed a shield. It's not. It's a floor plan. It's not the only one. This is the Holy Sepulchre. This is the money pit. This is this is Royston Cave. I won't tell you the measurements of this. It's in the book. This is also, notice this fish right here. This gives you another angle. So you've got the working compass, but you also have this angle here. Right next to that, you've got King Richard the Lionheart and his queen, who was never crowned in England. So her crown is floating above her head. I don't know how much time we have, but I'm so proud of these two discoveries of Melusine, the compass swords. If you were to read the available literature on Royston Cave going back to 1742 and look at the dates that my work came out, you will notice no one else has preceded me in these discoveries. This is the holy grail of what my soul does. Literally. You know, this is what makes me tick. And it's a horrible thing to discover that others whose work you I even admired, you know, in the past, might have even quoted in the past, are trying to take something that I did and twist it to their, to create their moment out of, and I'm very much alive. It's not as if I'm dead or anything,
you know? Well, I mean, even you give credit to the dead.
We're all standing on someone else's shoulders, and all I ask is cite your sources.
That's
you
it.
Don't have to like me, and I will be incredibly diplomatic, shake your hand, acknowledge your work, because when you have a movement, Mary Magdalene is so important to millions of people around the world. As a leader, the first Christian, if you will, tasked at the empty tomb with telling the others of the resurrection. So she is the first Christian. She's the first disciple. So a movement that's lasted 2,000 years in secrecy doesn't happen where everybody likes each other, but it's wise to cite the work of others and to figure out a business-like professional manner in which to work with them. And it's interesting. Wow. I've studied these caves for a long time, and it's funny to watch others try to ride on the back of it, of either the Margate Shell Grotto, Royston Cave, even Cainton Cave, and get it wrong because they don't understand the geology of the structure they're even dealing with, because they have no scientific background. They haven't looked at the studies. Mm. They haven't done the hard work. They haven't looked at the medieval customs. They haven't looked at the armor that's being displayed here. The carvings in this cave can't be earlier than 1204, when Eleanor of Aquitaine died, all the way on up to the time of Edward III, when armor is beginning to become more and more plate oriented and away from a chain link, which is what the Templars wore.
Yeah.
They wore chain link with hauberks, padding, leather padding, it wasn't till much later that you get plate armor, which is what starts showing up in Royston. So I know when these carvings took place. I honestly think the structure was there when Lady Roisia gave her name to the town. Now, some people say that Royston means King's Town. R-O-I in French means king, and then town. Now, yes, James was there. There is a strong French component to him. However, Rex is Latin and favored by the English culture in London, in which he stepped into out of Edinburgh. So most of his documents, I'm going to hedge my bets here, were termed Rex, not Roy. Mm. There's a medieval document where a pope notes Roisia, I think it's 1180, the town of Lady Roisia. So we know she was there. She was important. Her husband was important too. You know, they were heroes. But I don't believe these carvings were there at that time. They couldn't predate 1204, and they go on all the way up to the reign and shortly after of Edward III.
Wow.
So there's that. Now a little bit of expression here. You take those swords out of the wall, you use them in the landscape, and you find a lot of really interesting locations and dates. And I'm just so proud that my years of research The privilege I've had in the, you know, living in the UK, having boots on the ground in Western Europe predominantly, have led me to discover Melusine in Royston Cave and, the incredible dragon tradition across Europe and Arthur, the head dragon. Arthur Pendragon is bear head dragon and the compass properties of these two swords, the hidden code on the walls of Royston. I probably said way too much.
That is far from it. Honestly, it is great to finally see this work.
Thank you.
I know we have been talking privately for a long, long time, and even before our previous episode with Codes of the Hidden King.
Thank you.
That was held very, very close to the chest for a long time. Yeah. Just
it's
as
been
this
a tough few years. It's been a tough few years. I've Codes of the Hidden King took 2 years and 3 months to get out. And that was with the incredible codebreaker, William Russell, and symbolist, John Edwards. And there was some crossover there of between the three of us, but myself as the lead writer, combining our work was quite a physical feat. And, I felt compelled due to, dates of television programs that were looming, that I really needed to get everything I knew about Royston Cave out and down before others just mistakenly thought that this was bog standard knowledge. Melusine, the mermaid, the sword, compass. This is not bog standard 300-year-old knowledge.
Yeah.
Not by any stretch. This is, came off the back of my years of work. Yeah. Not only, now I'm an independent outside researcher. I've had the privilege of being highlighted in 2018, again in 2022. I've had the privilege of having further work scrutinized last year for season 13. They chose to go a different direction. And of course, you know, I'm an outsider, so they have to go with their inner group. I will continue my work. I'm fascinated with the island, its history, because it involves the mystery of what's buried on the island.
Yeah.
And both these books that I published respectively with my co-authors and myself in 2026, Oak Island is so important to these two books. The Codes of the Hidden King doesn't really talk about Oak Island, but without Codes of the Hidden King, you don't have the why of Oak Island. Mm. And certainly Royston Cave has a direct relationship, which the compass swords show, with Oak Island and Portugal and the Holy Land.
Wow. Wow. So, and do me a favor and bring your camera back full screen for the last few minutes here so we can discuss a few of these things that you have covered during this truly amazing presentation, Gretchen. I'm so happy to have you on to talk about this stuff. The compass swords are fascinating. And honestly, I've got them up just so everybody knows. This is Virtronics360.world. They do all kinds of like 360 scans of places, things like that. And this is a cool detailed scan that gives you all kinds of history. But when you actively look at this, you can see how it is a compass. And even whenever you zoom in on that, on the circles, you can see a very distinct compass on the circles itself.
Yeah, that has been described as a shield. There's another one in the cave too. The problem with that, I think, now I do have some background in armor, medieval armor. I won't say I'm an expert. I do think they're wrong about the shield. It's too small. That yeah. kind of a small handheld shield comes many centuries later when you've got a lighter weight blade where you can then use, you know, where you're thrusting.
Yeah,
you know,
that was much more used with,
you know,
rapiers.
Rather than, yeah, exactly. You know, fencing versus broadswords.
Now, granted, the Irish did use small shields like that. The Celts did.
So,
with the Arthurian connection, that's fascinating to think about, because yes, the Celts did use small, I guess it would have been close to the Middle Ages, things like that.
Well, the historic Arthur, I don't have a problem with him going back to the end of the Roman period.
Absolutely.
When the Romans leave and the Romano-Britons start being overrun by Saxons.
Yeah.
And then you get this Romano-Briton war leader who is carrying a Roman dragon standard. Now, that doesn't mean that Royston Cave was in existence at that point. In fact, I know it wasn't. There are no Roman finds that have ever been discovered at that crossroads. No Mithras altar, no other altar. Nothing has ever been interred there, and there have been excavations. Typically at a crossroads, a Roman crossroads, you have a wayfinder marking, you have an altar, you know, you might even have a small Roman town, etc., but nothing's ever been discovered there, and that's part of Royston's literature that's never been disputed. So, you know, and again, I believe the structure was there because Royston was booming, and Lady Rosia de Vere was memorializing her husband. And I think that he was laid in what started out as a dean hole. And she then created into a shrine. And then later on, after Eleanor of Aquitaine dies, after 1204, Lady Rosia is long gone. The carvings start hitting. The Templars are more active and Royston. But now, so you know, it's, so there is a window. And I tell you, if you don't come to the war room and you don't come with masters to PhD level content and do an information dump with them, and you make a mistake, they'll laugh you out of the room.
Absolutely.
So if you don't do your due diligence, it might not make it to the screen, you know, and I've always done my best to come to the table with everything that I had. And I was thrilled to have the opportunity to film with them, you know, and I was so excited on filming day. They had to keep refilming me because, you know, I met Marty, Lagina, Alex, and Charles Barkhouse. And Charles Barkhouse has a place in my heart because he's a Templar aficionado, a historian for the island. And he walked up to me and said, Gretchen, you've got Templaritis and you'll never get rid of it. And yeah, Templaritis, I've got it. But I shook hands with the team members, and I was so excited, you know, that I was told by Larry, the producer, to turn around and start walking across the street to where the entrance was. And I took off like a shot three times. They couldn't follow me. I went so quickly. So I was so excited. I just couldn't wait to get down there. Anyway, they were wonderful. It was a great experience. It was a wonderful experience, and they treated me so well on the day.
And once again, your work into this, your work into its connection with Eleanor of Aquitaine, your work with its connection to the Templars, and even specifically, once again, I find two things very interesting. Number one, yes, that pagan hand sign. As mentioned, but also the compass. I have seen the two swords before, Gretchen.
Yeah.
As we've talked about that, we've talked about this at least a few times since we've had you on, and this is the first time that I am seeing those two swords as an actual compass. And once again, when you zoom in, like right there in between them, I guess what you're saying, they typically call a shield.
I think it's a floor plan, but all of these things have multiple meanings. And it's important because it's touching the sword, which is at an angle, which means it's directing you to a sanctuary. Now, the interesting thing with the Sheila Nagig and the Uffington horse, that goes back to deep Europe, where you can't shake the goddess of the land. And the you've got the oculus there up above, you've got Mother Earth, and you've got the sun that comes through that oculus. Now, the oculus would have always been covered to protect it from rain. The structure did suffer from rain damage until it's always had to be protected. And there are star constellations above that at varying times of year are important. But you've got the concept of the light, the father light coming into the land and regenerating life. Because without sunlight, we can't live. Without our Mother Earth, we can't live. And the Templar swords are Excalibur. Edward III loved and aligned himself with Arthurian lore. And I've done a case study and timeline of all Arthurian writers. It's pretty extensive in the back. And when some of these key historic individuals were alive at what time and who was writing at that time. So the Rochefoucauld Grail is an illuminated manuscript that was done potentially by Cistercians. Templars are Cistercians with swords, right? So the Rochefoucauld Grail is pretty trippy too, and you and I have talked about that in the past. So here you have this illuminated Arthurian manuscript that we don't recognize that storyline today, where the Grail is being depicted as Lancelot's head on a platter after having his head struck off by the Green Knight.
Yeah.
And, pretty rough stuff.
Well, and interestingly, though, whenever you go down that road, a big, big connection to that is the connection of the king to the land.
Exactly.
And like that is a huge part of Arthurian lore, was the fact that until the finding of King Arthur, the land was squalor. It was bad. You know, the crops were failing, things like that. And
he marries the land.
Yeah, yeah.
He revitalizes the land, and sometimes he is sacrificed for the land.
Yeah.
Very, very Christ-like in tradition. And, of course, nobody wants to lose their hero. But Arthur was certainly, historically, I believe he existed. But at least five other kingdoms claim him as their historic king. But we're looking at a tradition, the dragon tradition, the Arthurian tradition, the king of the land. So it's a tradition, and it's all kind of gotten muddled up, especially in Western Europe. But it takes has a presence in the Order of the Dragon in Eastern Europe as well. So you cannot separate Western Europe from Royston Cave, as others have tried to do recently, and state that this carving of Melusine is only Lady Roisia de Vere, and it belongs only to the Dragon Arthur of England, when it's clearly academically not sound to make that statement. So, I'm so grateful for you, Christopher, for giving me a platform to speak about this. I've been meaning to get back to this topic for a long time, but, you know, it's just been tough trying to keep up with everything. Oak Island is quite demanding. Everything else I'm doing is demanding. I've got other projects that have been simmering on back burners I can't even get to. And now I found myself in a position of having to be forced to get this out as quickly as I could. to the highest level with which I could. And this book comprises years of research going back to 2006 when I first stepped foot in Royston Cave.
Wow.
And that's a long time. And then realizing over that period of time, the connections to Oak Island, Eleanor of Aquitaine, Melusine, Arthurian tradition, the compass swords, everything. It's a teaching tool, a ceremonial chamber that's meant to blow your mind and create a new person out of you.
I was going to say, just this panel alone, if you are talking about trying to carry on a mythology from person to person, that you're teaching something, an initiation, what have you. This is a great arc of a story of a panel that would any other time typically be in tapestry form, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Or even to the fact of, you know, a church panel. You know, yeah. where when you start looking at things, especially in the way that things were done for panels that portrayed the arc of humanity, the creation, yeah, the crucifixion, the end times, you know, things like Hieronymus Bosch,
yes,
stuff like
oh
that. So
yeah,
when you start interpreting it and looking at it in that kind of way of how it goes from, yeah, almost wild man over on the left and the idea of pagan symbols and then coming into Christianity and enlightenment, yeah, and that Arthurian part of things, moving on from Maryland.
You even have a fish.
Like that.
There's a fish on the right-hand,
yeah,
side of that upright sword,
yep,
that creates another measurement. And that is also in the book. You know, I won't share everything here. I've shared quite a lot.
So much.
But
so much.
I'm very happy to be here to share this. But if you get your ruler out and you start drawing lines through these swords and through that fish. So you're talking about the Fisher King. You're talking about the fishers of men. And at the top of that food chain is the mermaid and the dragon. The mermaid dragon, she's got a pair of wings and she's flying through the sky with a mermaid tail. of course that all goes, this is all hidden lore that goes all the way back to 2000 years. That's an incredible stretch of time.
Yeah. And
it
takes
is.
Its connection straight back to Mary Magdalene. All kinds of things, as we've,
yes,
talked about before with you.
And she is represented in the cave in another way as well. She's represented seated at the tomb. And so this cave is very female friendly. There are a lot of women depicted, saints, and now again, the only other crowned individual you'll see in here are either actual female rulers or Saint Catherine, who was a princess. So, you know, there are strict penalties because royals were considered divine secular representatives of God on earth.
Yes.
You start messing around with their mantle, their crowns, their swords of state, you're in trouble. You're either going to be executed for heresy, or you're going to be ostracized in some way. So the only other woman you'll see wearing a crown in here is Saint Catherine of the Wheel, Richard the Lionheart's wife. And even her crown is floating above her head because she was never officially crowned in England. And that's how much it mattered to these people at the time, the status of a crown.
Yeah.
It cannot be ascribed to Lady Royzia de Vere, but she is a heroine. So is her husband.
And once again, the symbology that is in here, especially once you get to St. Catherine, everything else like you're talking about is,
yeah,
absolutely,
yeah,
detailed and awesome.
She's amazing. And her height is nearly as tall as the crucifix, the crucifixion scene next. And the wheel as a navigation compass, geometry. She is a Templar saint for a reason. She's often depicted with a pen. So she's transmitting the secrets and teaching the secrets of navigation to the next generation. As a Christian saint, she was martyred on a wheel, but that wheel is really handy for a cover story. So if you circle round to the right, keep going to the right. There you go. Now, do you see Saint Christopher? There you go. And we know that that's him because Jesus is on his shoulder.
Right there.
Now, you'll see a tomb. And that female figure is Mary Magdalene on the left. On the left, you'll see a tomb. That's a rectangular tomb. And this, I believe, to be another image of Mary Magdalene. And you, on top, you have the long arm of God releasing the dove of the Holy Spirit, which is feminine. Yeah. The dove of the Holy Spirit is another way of, it was a way of hiding Mary Magdalene's true identity, which was done over a very long time. And I know that's controversial, but she is the dove of the Holy Spirit. She is the bride, the queen in exile. She is the political queen of Jerusalem, but she is waiting in the empty tomb, and the resurrection, if you will, has happened above her through the long arm of God and releasing the healing dove of the Holy Spirit. So she's represented more than once in this cave, and that's one image of her that I believe has gone unidentified, along with Melusine, which is also a coded image of her. So
wow,
it's been a lot of hard work. I'm grateful to be here at this juncture. And I didn't leave very many stones unturned with this volume. I wish I could have spent more time on it, but I was facing a clock, a deadline, a date. And
I'm honestly glad that you were, Gretchen, because all too often, especially when it comes to works like this, it can become so consuming, and new things can pop up so regularly that you hesitate putting work out. You know, new revelations happen, new connections happen. You meet other researchers and you find out other information. But I think it's one of those, as we've discussed before, the idea of getting it out there in this format, in this kind of really, and as always, the research is deep. It's great. I mean, you can just see what I've read so far and the bookmarks I have to go back and relook at things, especially with the connection to water and the Cistercians and their terraforming of things, their creation of such, you know, their connection with such things. So
they blow me away. Their capacity to move water, 2.5 miles, you know, this is an abbey in France, but they are so incredibly remarkable. And this was a double pronged attempt by the Cistercians and the Templars to change culture, to change the culture of Europe and the Middle East. So it's remarkable.
I think your work here with Royston specifically has gone a long way to expose a lot of the connections from the Middle East to royalty, to as we've talked about, the ruling families of Europe, all kinds of things, Gretchen, and how this cave has been connected with all of that over the many, many years. So thank you for all your work always. It's always great to see what you've done, what you have garnered, and what you've brought to the table, because it is a lot. It's a lot.
Thank you. It's a labor of love. I sure felt beat up after it. So I'm happy to be feeling more rested and sitting here smiling and talking with you. I appreciate your time. I always enjoy being here with you and having an opportunity, though I can't see those on the other end of this screen. You know, thank you for your time as well.
So. Absolutely. Well, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of The Curse of Oak Island's Templar Cave Royston, where they can go to get Codes of the Hidden King, all of your books, Gretchen, where they can go to keep up with your work and everything.
Thank you. GretchenCormwell.com has links to the books that are available on Amazon. They're a little bit more expensive than your average book because they are in color. They require a little bit heavier paper to prevent bleed through from imagery into text on the other side. So, but we can't separate image from the Knights Templar on up through the Age of Exploration, the Stuart era, because we're visual creatures. Everything's done visually in artwork, as you could see in Royston Cave. We are visual. Everything's visual. So myself and my co-authors try to get that across, that hopefully these books are portals, that they are an adventure in themselves. Books can be a way of self-initiation. There are times I'll Absolutely. Pick up a book and I'm so astounded by what I've read. I feel like I've changed by the very act of reading the book and holding that book in my hand. And I hope, and my co-authors hope, that Codes of the Hidden King and of course, my own work, Royston, has that change on the reader as well. So yes, Amazon.com. These ebooks on Kindle are static, faithful reproductions, a print reproduction, because the text has to match the pictures.
Yep.
There is no flowable text. So Amazon requires that they are published as static representations, like a illustrated book or manga, or you know, any kind of an illustrated book would be. They're static representation. Comic books are static representations. I've had people say, "Oh, I can't read it. The text doesn't flow." Well, it's not supposed to, because it can't, because the text is integral to the picture, such as explaining the compass swords. So,
Well, once again, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, for coming on, for chatting. It is always great talking with you. There is always revelatory information, and I cannot wait to see what comes out next from Gretchen Cornwell. So, thanks so much as always, my friend. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Gretchen Cornwell at GretchenCornwell.com, make sure to remember there is the Virtronics360.world. That's where you can go see that 360 view of Royston Cave that we were showing off, complete with art history, all kinds of things. While you're checking out those, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can find all of the YouTube channels of our guests and more. That's also where you can find Curious Research. We are very proud to announce the release of our all new Cromfit, folks, the Curious Research online media file inspection tool. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFOs, ufology, cryptozoology, if people send you pictures and you are trying to find out the data from inside of them, this very easy tool allows you to import it, and it shows you all kinds of data completely from the file itself. If it has the camera type, it'll show you the camera type. If it has geolocation, it'll show it. You can go in and inspect things, zoom in, all kinds of stuff for proper inspection. You can have clone detection to see if anybody has copy-pasted things inside of there. You can analyze audio. You can analyze video. This is your one-stop shop to be able to investigate all things that are media. So stop on by, check that out. That is available for free online, folks. And let me tell you, it is utterly private. Your file never touches a server. It is processed in the browser and then deprecated, and you can export your file of all of your data that you have gathered. So that is for free use there at curiousresearch.org/tools. Thank you so much, everybody, for your open hearts, for your open minds. That is what it takes for the conversation to exist. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.